Coming to you from the ancestral territory of the Anishinaabe and the area inhabited by the Haudenosaunee and the Mississaugas of the Credit First Nation, this is Earth Matters. I'm your host, Lawson Hunter. Earth Matters examines the impacts we have on the environment and the natural world around us, seeking solutions, reporting on news and events, presenting positive alternatives, and highlighting the steps others are taking. We hope to inspire you to join the many others who are working to preserve and protect a healthy planet. Earth Matters has been broadcasting on radio and podcasting for 2 years now, over 100 shows. I've met and chatted with leading experts studying complex issues and regular folks just trying to make a difference in their daily lives. Guests have come from England, Germany, Uganda, Kenya, New Zealand, Australia, all over the United States, and of course, Canada, where I'm from. Why am I saying all this? It's because Earth Matters, the podcast and radio show, is coming to a close. It's been a joy to discuss various different solutions to environmental problems, and while my subjects have been diverse and wide-ranging, I still feel I've only scratched the surface, which is a good thing. It means there is a lot more out there. As I say in the intro, Earth Matters sought out solutions, reported on news and events, and hopefully inspired listeners to preserve and protect our planet. So, to wrap things up, I've compiled a series of short clips from previous shows, in no particular order, to show that others are taking positive steps and that there is much more to come, if we can all focus on what's important for the natural world around us. Good luck, and thanks for listening. Author and filmmaker Helena Noberg Hodge is the founder and director of Local Futures. A pioneer of the new economy movement, she has been promoting an economics of personal, social, and ecological well-being for more than 30 years.
Then I also had help from an organization started by E.F. Schumacher, who wrote the book Small is Beautiful. Mm-hmm. And that book had really influenced me because I actually read it in my first year in Ladakh, and he was an economist and a man, a very important economist, very mainstream. And he had had almost identical experience in Burma, where he had also found that people who had not been colonized and who were still living according to their own skills and with ways that they had developed over many centuries, managing their own resources, you know, there was no real poverty. I mean, poverty, as we know it, is really a creation of an economic system that in a very short time in Ladakh, and later on I witnessed it also in Bhutan and other places, creates unemployment. You know, unemployment never existed traditionally. There was just no such thing. So there's this artificial creation of scarcity of livelihoods, and through this channel of energy-intensive technologies and top-down, either big business or large bureaucracies. So questioning all that and trying to promote an understanding about the need for more localized economic development, a way of strengthening local economies worldwide, that's something that we started doing very early on. And later on, the organization we named it Local Futures. But we're also known as the Economics of Happiness, because that's really what localization offers, is by strengthening people's self-esteem and their ability to have secure livelihoods and to be more interdependent with human scale institutions, so that, you know, they're not dependent on giant unknown corporations or government bureaucracies where there's not even a name, no face, you don't really know what these forces are, we don't know who owns our water, we have no idea who produces our food, it all goes via these enormous institutions and over great distances. So when you start shortening the distances and people start becoming more dependent, as I say, on each other and on human scale institutions, there's an amazing shift that happens. And we're very proud and very happy to have been pioneers of promoting that around the world.
Gil Penalosa, a former Parks Commissioner for Bogota, Colombia, founded 880 Cities. 880 Cities is a nonprofit organization bringing citizens together to enhance mobility and public space so that they can create a more vibrant, healthy, and equitable community. Penalosa has traveled to more than 300 communities around the world, looking for the best ideas to improve life for people of all ages. He believes the measure of a good place is whether we'd feel comfortable with an 8-year-old biking alone to a neighborhood park or someone in their 80s walking to the grocery store.
It really is about improving the quality of life of everybody. Even doing parks in areas with very poor people, sometimes people will question, you know, why are you doing parks in such low-income areas when the poor people have so many needs? I said, yeah, if you really care about poor people, when the poor people feel miserable, it's in the leisure time. When they are working, the CEO of a bank or a minimum wage worker cleaning the floors have a similar experience. Maybe even the CEO has more anxiety. But on the leisure time, on the weekends, the CEO has theaters and restaurants and country clubs and cottages and travels. And so the minimum wage worker doesn't have options. So if we improve how the low-income people are using the leisure time, we're really improving the quality of life of everybody. So that was something that I was obsessed. How could we really improve quality of life of everyone? And also, how could we use parks and streets and open spaces, all public spaces, as something where we could work on as equalizers, and how this would improve the environment and economic development and happiness, and also thinking about health, both physical health and mental health. So those were some of the driving forces. And then I moved to Canada about 20 years ago this May. And I've been obsessed with the topic. And I founded 880 Cities about 13 years ago. And 880 Cities has a simple but powerful concept. Is what if everything that we did in our city, the sidewalk, the crosswalk, the park, the library, the restaurant, the building, everything had to be great for an 8-year-old and for an 80. It's not 8 to 80, but it's 8 and 80 as an indicator species. Mm-hmm. Because if it's good for the 8 and it's good for the 80, it's going to be good for everybody from 0 to over 100. We need to stop building cities as if everybody was 30-year-old and athletic, and build cities for all. So that is the concept of 880, which is totally integrated and issues related to parks and public spaces, streets, sidewalks, plazas, but also issues such as sustainable mobility, walking, cycling, riding public, taking public transit, new uses of cars, and so on.
In Protecting Pollinators, How to Save the Creatures That Feed Our World, beekeeper and author Jody Helmer explores why pollinator decline has become so dire and how it can be reversed. Her book, published by Island Press, offers a hopeful vision for the future of pollinators. Not just the iconic monarch butterfly and the dainty hummingbird, but the drab hawk moth and the homely bats that are just as essential.
You know, it started really with curiosity, as I think all good things do. About 7 years ago, my husband wanted to start keeping bees, and so I got him a beehive for Christmas. And at the time, I was too scared to go out and work the bees with him. And so he would bring the frames over to the window where I stood behind the safety of a screen, and we would talk about the hive. And over time, I got so fascinated with the bees and the colony that I really wanted to learn more. And fortunately, as a journalist, I'm able to sell articles about the things that I want to learn more about and ask nosy questions of the people who know the topic best. And so I started writing a lot about bees and beekeeping. And the more I learned, the more I wanted to know and realized that bees, while they are very important pollinators, are not the only pollinators. And so really one thing led to another. And this beekeeping journey that I never wanted to be a part of turned into this incredible fascination with not only bees, but the other creatures that pollinate for us. And it was really a nice connection between the gardening that I do and the bees that we keep. And so it really all came full circle, and I was able to learn a lot more when I started writing the book.
Growing crops to feed farm animals is vastly inefficient, driving up the price of grains and legumes and entrenching global poverty. The challenge to produce enough food for 9 billion people by 2050 requires a more efficient system and less food waste. The Good Food Institute works with scientists, investors, and entrepreneurs to discover improved methods and use all the tools of science to uncover new ways of producing healthy and nutritious food. GFI, as it's known, has placed a focus on clean meat and plant-based alternatives to animal products. Foods that are more delicious, safer to eat, and better for the planet than traditional production methods.
The Good Food Institute is a nonprofit organization that exists to answer what we think are two of the biggest questions facing our global food system today. And those questions are, how can we feed the world's growing population, which is expected to be almost 10 billion people by the year 2050? And how can we do that in a way that is good for people and the planet? And so as what we think of as two of the most promising solutions to those questions are plant-based meat and cell-based meat. When we say plant-based meat, essentially what we mean are meat products that are made from plant ingredients. Typically, these have been things like veggie burgers or plant-based sausages. And on the cell-based side, what that means is that using techniques of tissue engineering, we're actually able to produce meat, a product that is at the cellular level, analogous to existing animal meat, but instead of raising an entire animal, we're able to produce just the part that is consumed, so the actual meat product. So GFI exists to help advance the plant-based and cell-based industries.
The use of plastics today is a highly wasteful, linear, take-make-waste model that is harmful to the environment and misses economic opportunities as value is literally thrown away. This linear economy for plastics requires energy and generates emissions for each production cycle that would largely be avoided if plastic otherwise was reused or effectively recycled. In a report to the Smart Prosperity Institute, Usman Valiente examines the current state of plastic waste and offers solutions to the global epidemic of plastic waste. Governments, corporations, and consumers all have a role to play. Tougher regulations, judicious and recyclable use of plastics, extended producer responsibility, and smarter consumer choices can all contribute to reducing the amount of plastic filling up our world.
I think global awareness of the impacts of climate change, I think issues around awareness of, you know, water pollution, and most recently, you know, the discussion of plastics in the environment really have captured the public's imagination on this. They're starting to understand you know, the implications of some of these things, the cumulative effects of some of these things. And there's a real push for the public from action, and the public are consumers. And I think business is responding. I also think that governments are responding, and the response that you're getting from governments, things like banning certain types of plastics, driving electric vehicles through subsidies. We just saw some of that activity in the Canadian budget. So, you know, business is looking at what governments are doing. Governments are responding to the public concern. And I think they realize that, you know, the days of just taking raw materials and energy, shipping over to developing countries, producing products, shipping them back, using them, and then dumping them, that economic model is not going to work in the future. And so we need a wholesale evolution of how we produce and consume goods. You know, 45% of all of the greenhouse gas emissions that we generate are embedded in the goods that we consume. And so this also has a social equity or a wealth inequality aspect to it. I mean, if you look at globalization of production, that was really the product of being able to ship raw materials to places like China with very low cost, at very low cost, having, you know, low labor rates, low environmental standards there to produce goods, then having, again, low energy cost to move that produced goods back to North America. And the emissions and energy use and waste associated with how we produce things really drove globalization in many ways. And so if you know, all your emissions associated with moving stuff around are unpriced, and, you know, that's a huge subsidy to how you produce things, and that sort of incentivizes being very wasteful.
Kate Pepler moved to Canada's East Coast and attended Dalhousie University. There, she learned about environmental issues, and it troubled her that more wasn't being done to reduce waste and recycle. After a year of learning how to source sustainable items and reduce her own waste, Pepler created a website to inspire others to become more eco-conscious and began hosting workshops for people living in her new hometown, Halifax, Nova Scotia, to help them move towards a zero-waste lifestyle. Pepler opened a zero-waste store called Terre in the north end of Halifax to provide access to zero-waste shopping and coffee.
Yeah, we are such a disposable society. We want everything quick and easy, and we often don't think about the consequences of that. So I think things are shifting. So by us not providing disposable coffee cups, that's even if somebody, we have a mug library, so if somebody comes in wanting a coffee to go but doesn't have a travel mug, we have a mug library so they can take a mug for free and bring it back when they're next in the area. So the people who do that are now becoming more aware of the impact of their coffee cup, disposable coffee cup. And if they don't want to take a mug, then maybe they'll think next time they're in their house to bring their own travel mug. So I think it's all about just shifting our awareness and habits and changing from a disposable society.
We spoke with Cale Black, an inspiring young environmentalist who speaks from the heart and talks about the spirituality he experiences while talking to students about the environment, or when holding workshops on sustainability, or when he's sorting through 100 pounds of recycled material.
To me, spirituality and environmentalism has always been completely linked. And whether I could articulate it earlier in my life or not, I'm starting to sort of come up with the language for it now. But a really simple story, and I'll paraphrase it because it's a decent-sized one, is there is an indigenous sort of idea or story or belief that we don't just have like our physical body that we have right now. It's really like a flash in the pan in terms of the lifetime of bodies that we have in our life. So science will say that like every year we have pretty much a new body. We have new like blood cells, hair cells, skin cells, all that sort of stuff. Every 7 years we have almost a completely different body with almost no molecules that we have of like our physical bodies right now. So we're more of like a verb than we are a noun. We're constantly moving, constantly changing. Human beings are much more of a process than a fixed entity. And the idea that like we have this physical body that a lot of us are so attached to and we identify with so strongly, but there's also the idea that we have an extended body, and it's what will make up our physical body over the length of our lifetimes. And right now, because it's not in our bodies right now, it's out there in the earth, in the water we're going to drink, the food we're going to eat, the air we're going to breathe. So we literally are completely connected, intrinsically one with the earth and all of the natural materials that are here on the earth. So the idea that we're separate from the earth is literally just a mental concept, and it's not real. We are completely connected to the earth, and the fact that people think that they can put poison into the air, poison into the water, poison on our foods, and not have it affect us immediately is just insane. It's completely insane. And there is that insane mentality operating on so many levels of government, on so many levels of society, that there seems to be this separation that we can do things to the earth and not do it to ourselves.
From 2015 to 2019, Dr. Diane Sachs was the Environmental Commissioner of Ontario, an office that has since been abolished. She was appointed unanimously by all MPPs to report to the Legislature on Ontario's environmental, energy, and climate performance, and to be the guardian of the Environmental Bill of Rights. During her term, she improved the effectiveness of the Environmental Bill of Rights, increased public understanding of the urgency of climate change, and issued highly praised reports on a wide range of environmental, energy, and climate topics.
We've had a really unfortunate polarization that I've seen over my career, where a series of conservative or right-wing governments have been really hostile to science. So when you talk about the chill that occurred under Stephen Harper, the conservative government, who really strongly disliked the evidence that scientists were producing about the immense harm that fossil fuels cause, and instead of focusing on ways to reduce the harm, they focused on ways to shut up the scientists. We're seeing the same thing being repeated now under the Republican government in the U.S. So the focusing first on the federal government, the Liberal government is far from perfect. I've never seen a perfect government or a perfect human. But on the whole, they've been doing a pretty good job. Certainly, they take climate change more seriously than any government we've had before. And the Pan-Canadian Framework, which most of the provinces and territories and federal government agreed to together in 2016 as a way to work towards delivering our Paris commitment, a huge series of steps forward. Is it enough? No, but extremely important, including carbon pricing, but also serious work on science, some serious work on adaptation, some serious work on regulations to reduce pollution, such as the Clean Fuel Standard, and a really deeply serious attempt to make a national agreement to work on these issues. And that's really challenging for Canada, both because a big part of our economy is based on oil and gas.
The Indigenous Clean Energy Social Enterprise is a pan-Canadian, not-for-profit platform which advances Indigenous inclusion in Canada's energy futures economy through Indigenous leadership and broad-based collaboration with energy companies, utilities, governments, development firms, clean tech innovators, academic sector, and capital markets. The 2020 Catalyst Program is an award-winning, interactive three-month program that connects First Nations, Inuit, and Métis catalysts to a network of Indigenous and non-Indigenous clean energy project mentors and coaching specialists involved in clean energy project development, including energy efficiency, solar, wind, hydro, biomass, and geothermal, both on and off-grid. We spoke with Aaron Stewart, director of the 2020 Catalyst Program.
The Indigenous Clean Energy Social Enterprise is a not-for-profit, and our not-for-profit is focused on advancing the Indigenous inclusion and leadership in the clean energy sector. We have communities that participate in our programming from all across Canada, and they have had extreme impacts and incredible impacts in their communities on this file. So we also run within ICE a program called the 2020 Catalyst Program, and this is a national Indigenous clean energy capacity building program that we run every summer. And essentially at the core, what we do is we have 3-week-long intensive sessions, and we cover everything soup to nuts around clean energy, whether that be energy efficiency and conservation, building a renewable energy project, energy education for youth and elders and community members, community energy planning, how do you finance projects, employment opportunities. So we cover a whole spectrum of different opportunities in the clean energy sector, and essentially try to motivate and empower communities to lead their own projects in their own way. And we support them in doing that through mentorship with partners. And the program's actually led by about 35 different mentors from all across Canada. And these are a combination of Indigenous clean energy leaders who have done their own project in their own communities, as well as different technical support mentors. So they may be a lawyer that focuses on how to get a project off the ground, or an economic development officer, or an engineer who helps build the project. So we use a different combination of both community, Indigenous community support leaders, as well as technical mentors at our programming score.
This next clip is about permafrost, and specifically the impact that warmer temperatures are having on the melting permafrost that covers some 24% of the Northern Hemisphere. I spoke with Dr. Sean Carey. Dr. Carey directs the Watershed Hydrology Group at the School of Geography and Earth Sciences at McMaster University, and his research interests include hydrological, biogeochemical, and land surface processes in natural and human-impacted environments.
Permafrost is, I guess, technically defined as ground that is below 0 degrees Celsius for more than 2 years, but that's sort of a textbook definition. It's basically ground that's been frozen for a long period of time, and I think there are lots of challenges. There's geotechnical challenge, there's challenges to, you know, with the release of greenhouse gases and other sort of things like that. But I think one of the biggest challenges is that within the permafrost, permafrost is a technical term. It could be frozen rock, it could be frozen soil, but it's there's a lot of ice in permafrost. And the big issue comes that when we melt this ice that exists within the permafrost, the ground degrades. So there's all you can imagine a structure that is 2 meters high, and underneath it is 1 meter of rock and 1 meter of ice. And when that ice disappears, the ground sinks a meter. And so any sort of building structure, any sort of bridges, any sort of infrastructure falls apart. That's the geotechnical aspect. Then there are these global aspects whereby there's a lot of methane locked up in permafrost and permafrost ice. As the soil's warm, microbes start chewing at this carbon that's been sequestered for tens of thousands of years. And that, you know, contributes more to the greenhouse gas contributions above and beyond our industrial activities. Permafrost is just frozen ground. As we travel north, even in northern Ontario, you start to pick up pockets of permafrost in wetlands, in areas where there's really thick organic soils. But as we traverse Canada and move farther north, essentially it's like a wedge. It's really thin at one end and sporadic. And as we move north, it becomes thicker and thicker and thicker. And areas of the high Arctic islands, it's thousands of meters, well, about 1,000 meter deep, hundreds of meters deep. So it's very permanent. And that's not going anywhere anytime soon, but there's a lot of places at the southern end of the permafrost that it's degrading quite rapidly in front of our eyes.